States Court of Appeals in and for the 7th Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Court versus Diversified Collection Services. Mr. Raphael.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The issue before this Court is whether DCS proved as a matter of law the bona fide heir affirmative defense. This Court reviews the summary judgment grant of the lower court de novo. Garnishment prior to a judgment is an exceptional remedy, and even more so with the administrative wage garnishment. But what I find ironic here is that DCS, a multi-million dollar national collection agency, cavalierly requires that a class of hundreds of unsophisticated consumers provide them with conclusive proof of an exemption to provide them with a temporary reprieve from the garnishment proceedings. But they're asking this court to take for granted DCS's own self-serving statements that lack any foundation, as if they're the gospel. To prove DCS's affirmative defense, they have to show a violation that was due to a mistake or an error, notwithstanding procedures reasonably adapted to avoid that mistake or error.
Well, they got this letter from the Department of Education.
Well, actually,
telling them what to do. So,
actually, Your Honor, this letter, there's no foundation that this came from the Department of Education to this agency. The letter itself is directed towards the guarantee agencies that do wage garnishments for the Department of Education themselves. It's not directed to DCS. DCS is also under a different standard than these administrative guarantee agencies.
Well, where do you think the defendant got the template for its letter that you're complaining about? I think they just made it up and hadn't seen this form letter from the Department of Education?
I think that they did see this letter.
Right.
I think that they received this letter from their client,
right,
the Illinois Student Assistance Commission, but there's no directives.
So what? I don't understand.
Well, we asked them for any directives that were requiring them to use this letter. They didn't produce any of that. I asked them in Belva Biaga's deposition to produce any directives that they have requiring a collection agency, which is different from ISAD.
You don't regard this as a directive, this letter?
I don't regard it as a directive to collection agencies that they must use this letter, especially when that letter misstates the Higher Education Act requirements.
We've had a few cases that have actually given out information or sort of a safe harbor type of letter that attorneys in the Federal Fair Debt Collection Act can rely on. How is this any different?
Well, this court made findings. There's nothing to suggest that the Department of Education went ahead and did an administrative review of the one particular exemption at issue, which was, have you been fired from your prior employer and not been reemployed with your current employer for more than 12 months? There was nothing to suggest that any administrative proceeding, or in this case a trial, had occurred.
What would you like in the way of a letter?
Pardon?
What would you like in the way of a letter?
Well, at a minimum, I would like a review of this particular provision of the...
No, concretely, what kind of letter would you think proper to address to these borrowers?
I think that guidance is easily derived from the regulation.
Be concrete, would you please?
Oh, absolutely. The notice itself says, swear under penalties of perjury that you fall under one of these exemptions. Well, if we're to take as true these affidavits that are provided in the notice, that would be sufficient, because you're giving the debt collector knowledge under penalties of perjury, a sworn affidavit, that they fall under this exemption, and the regulation that interprets the statute says that should be enough, knowledge of this exemption. I mean, here locally...
Well, there's the question, of course, what is knowledge?
Well,
you might be suspicious of a self-serving affidavit, and you might prefer some third-party verification.
Well,
couldn't that be within the scope of the who knows regulation?
Certainly, there is a hearing that goes on with these administrative wage garnishments. If DCS or any of the other debt collectors felt that somehow the self-serving affidavit was suspicious, then they would have an opportunity to
Well, they might not be suspicious on its face. They might just want, as they say, third-party verification. Is that
well, they want conclusive proof, but that's not...
Pardon?
They want conclusive proof of a temporary reprieve where they're...
Well, not conclusive, but they might want a letter from the State Employment Service.
Well, that's an interesting point. What State Employment Service? Because the letter itself... isn't specific as to what administrative body the unsophisticated consumer needs to go to get some sort of a statement. And when we look at the time requirements that the letter itself provides for the consumer, we're cutting down that time period to a very small time period in order to gain the temporary reprieve from an administrative wage garnishment. The letter goes out, and as was determined in the lower court, it was misdated, but 3 days later, presumably, the consumer gets it. They have 27 days to go ahead.
You know, I think your point about the time is good, but as far as ambiguity as to who you get the proof from, this template letter, Department of Education says, satisfactory written proof is the following. Documents from the fill-in name of State Employment Commission.
Why should that be a limited set of requirements? I mean, for example, here locally, Fannie Mae closed down. There's certainly knowledge on the part of people that company closed down. So a consumer says, I was employed by Fannie Mae, and now I'm employed by the Brock's Chocolate Factory. They would fall under this exemption, and they would get a reprieve for 12 months. I mean, these exemptions are meant to benefit consumers who are hardest hit.
Why do you think the Department of Education wants this documentation?
You know, that would leave me to speculate what was in their mind. I don't know that they actually had a reason, because there's no evidence to suggest why this language was put into the letter in the first place. All we know is that DCS was told by ISAC to use this letter. There was no analysis of it. There was no questioning of it. I mean, this goes back to the bona fide error defense, the second part of it. What was the procedure that DCS had in place to determine whether this letter should be used? All of the questions that your honors are posing to me are the very questions that would have been the procedure in place for DCS to question why this letter clearly...
What is DCS supposed to do? Go to the Department of Education? Say, who is Patricia Newcomb?
Well, you know, the letter itself says, if there are any questions concerning the use of these new notices, please contact me or George Harris. And here's a phone number. All DCS had to do was pick up the phone.
What good would that do?
What
they
could
didn't
that
have any questions concerning the use of these new notices. Your question you raise is its validity.
Well, they certainly would have had a question as to its use if they analyzed it, because when I took the deposition of Belva Biaga, I mean, she cited to me verbatim sections of the Higher Education Act, and then this notice added things to that didn't exist in the Act and also didn't exist in the regulation.
You're talking about the time?
The timing, which was...
And whether or not they had to come up with some information like
within 30 days.
Change jobs? Yeah, well,
yeah.
What... length, you say because it's not written in the statute, they have an unlimited amount of time to respond.
No, they have the 12-month period. This is an exemption that just you just can't take the money over that 12-month period. So if 6 months goes by after I've been fired from my prior job, I should be able to not be...
Wait 6 months before you tell them.
You know, yeah, you should be able to.
Yeah, but see, that's part of the problem. So you just sit there and say, well, gee, so you, and effectively you have to wait 12 months because then, well, the 12 months is run, so she, you know, whatever.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that 6 months later, if I want to tell them about the fact that I'm covered by this exemption, I should be able to be covered by the exemption.
But you know you're covered now. Why can't you tell them now?
You know, I don't know the answer to that specific hypothetical.
I don't want to run
depend.
The time out here.
I'd like to reserve the rest
okay,
of the time for
thank
rebuttal.
You, Mr. Raphael. Ms. McTeague?
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Christine Olson McTeague, and I represent DCS in this case. Here the District Court entered DCS's motion for summary judgment as to count two of the complaint, finding that DCS did, in fact, have the bona fide error
defense.
Following
up on Judge Mannion's question, if after, suppose the person hasn't bothered to notify you that his job has been terminated, but 6 months later he wakes up and says, oh, by the way, you know, I've been fired. So wouldn't he be entitled, not to get his money back or anything, but wouldn't he be entitled from that point on to a rescission of the garnishment?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that anything to do with rescission of the garnishment is in the hands of DCS. I think that is in the hands of the creditor, ISAC. But in the Federal Register comments regarding...
Well, it's a question of what you have to notify these people about their rights.
But in the Federal Register on this provision of the Code of Federal Regulation, the agency says, now this does not go to time, but it goes to the provision of notice. It says, well...
Why don't you answer my question? So you say in your letter you must establish a written repayment agreement on or before March 6th. Otherwise, Illinois Student Assistance will proceed to collect this debt through deductions from your pay. Now, the question is, well, suppose court failed to do that, but suppose, you know, a month later, 2 months later, 3 months later, discovers the problem, and she discovers the problem, and at that point she submits the proof that you require. So wouldn't she be entitled at that point to stop the garnishment?
To be honest, Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question because I am not familiar with how ISAC works with getting
in. Well, if you don't know, then how is this notice adequate?
I don't think regarding the bona fide error defense, at least as we're talking to the second prong, the maintenance of procedures originally designed to...
Could you speak up?
Sorry. At least as far as the second prong of the bona fide error defense goes, I believe the issue is, was it reasonable for DCS to rely on this form being provided to it by the government
agency?
That's
a separate question, because you also argue that there's no violation, right?
That's our alternative argument,
yeah.
Yes.
So my question is there adequate communication to the borrower of what happens if she doesn't discover or is not able to obtain the requisite documentation after March 6th?
As I read count two, and as I saw the issue in count two, the issue was the provision of documentation, not so much the time, because that is where, obviously, we lost as to count one. And that is where the district court found against us.
Now, in the template letter, this Education Department letter says you must establish a written payment agreement with, you know, name of the agency, on or before, and then there's a blank for the date.
Correct.
Now, do you interpret that to mean that you could put in anything, any date?
Your Honor, I'm sorry.
2 days from the date of the letter?
No, I don't, Your Honor, because in the relevant section of the Code of Federal Regulations provides that the notice must be sent at least 30 days. So I don't think you could put in a two-day requirement. I think it has to be the 30 days. And again, as I said, that is where...
Where is that? Where's the 30 days?
That is in...
Is that in the statute? Or
yes, Your Honor.
Or?
It is at 34 CFR 682.410, small b, 9.1, cap b. And that gives the 30 days provision.
Okay.
Well, if someone didn't exercise, let's just say they're working and they're notified of the garnishment and they choose, well, that's probably an efficient way to pay it off, but then after 6 months they say, you know, this is really a hardship. Could they then assert that defense? That's probably a different way of asking the same question.
Right, it is. And I apologize. Since I don't know the workings of ISEC, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I know how these agencies work from a practical standpoint, which is not in the record.
Obviously, if she gets fired or laid off or something, then there's not going to be any garnishment.
Correct.
So that stops. So I guess that alerts somebody that, gee, maybe there's something wrong here. So it would have, that would certainly put it into neutral.
I would think so. These agencies and collection agencies all work in different ways in collecting these debts. I don't want to go outside the record, but from my experience, they take a very practical approach to trying to get their money. But again,
Judge Mannion's question reminds me of another curiosity about this case. If the person is unemployed, there are no wages to garnish. So why does one need to go have all this notice business? You know, no wages, no garnishment.
Well,
wages, garnishment. So
I would think it is simply a protective measure that ISEC wishes to use,
What's it protecting? Because as Judge Mannion said, if the person has been fired and thus has no wages, there's not going to be anything to garnish. So.
But I think that the borrower in this case, the DOE, requested this information to have as much concrete or credible proof that, in fact, there are no wages.
But look, if you garnish someone's wages, I suppose that means you get a check every couple of weeks from the employer or from the bank where the wages are deducted, or wages are deposited. Well, if suddenly that stream of payments stops, you'd call up the employer presumably, and say, what happened?
Mm-hmm.
The employer would say, person's quit or been fired.
Right.
So why do you have to apply for this exemption? Why isn't it automatic?
Well, I could imagine there would be situations where the borrower may, in fact, have more than one job, maybe has not met both the prongs of the requirement that he or she's been separated from employment for the 12 months and then has not been continually reemployed, maybe has a sporadic work history. And in that case...
What's that reemployment provision?
You have been involuntarily separated from employment for the 12 months, but then you must be continuously reemployed for a certain period of time before your wages can be garnished again. So if you had, you know, a job here and there, you know, it wasn't a steady stream of employment, perhaps you have an example where
meet the 12-month requirement then.
Right.
If you got to hold a job for 12 months, apparently. So you'll never collect it. In fact, after 11 months, you change jobs. Well, I notice also on here the employer is identified in this notice prior to wage withholding. Now, I assume that's prior to notifying the employer, too, isn't it?
I believe so, yes.
And that protects them somewhat from embarrassment or whatever. They may choose to either pay or do something else.
Correct.
And it's kind of a deterrent to not paying.
I could imagine. I mean, you call some of... Oh, I'm sorry. I noticed my time has expired.
Well, you have another minute.
Oh, I really have nothing further to add unless the court has any further questions.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. McTighe. Mr. Raphael, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
I gave some thought to Your Honor's prior question about the time for this exemption to exist. And here's the situation that I could most readily envision. The notice in this case goes out no longer by certified mail but by regular mail, and there's delays in the mail process. A consumer could arguably get this notice very late, and after this 30-day time period by which they're supposed to provide this conclusive proof of their exemption to DCS, and based on the way that this notice is structured, they'd be discouraged from doing anything because they're told you got to do it within 30 days of the date of this notice. And so in that way, the language of the...
But if he's lost his job, what difference does it make? It's nothing to garnish.
Actually, no, this notice contemplates that you've lost your job and now you're currently reemployed. They don't usually send out these notices unless you're reemployed with a new place. See, the ISAC and the other guarantee agencies get...
Well, if you're reemployed, then what's your defense to being garnished?
You have to be reemployed for a period of 12 months. You could be reemployed...
12 months without being garnished, is that the idea?
Yes, you have a 12-month window of not being garnished.
I see. Okay, I
understand. See, ISAC gains from, and I think my time is up, but I'll try to answer your question. ISAC gains information about where these consumers are employed through Social Security records. They do this every quarter. And so a consumer could be employed and come up on the radar screen after a one-quarter period, and now they're trying to garnish that set of wages, which is why I say having to tell your present employer that you are the subject of a wage garnishment or that you owe some money would cause the consumer embarrassment, which they shouldn't have to go ahead and do because the statute says just knowledge is sufficient. Mm-hmm. Don't need to conclusively prove anything. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much, both counsel. Next case for argument.